Welcome to the News Roundup on the Point. I'm Indy Todd in for Steve Junker. Joining us today in studio from the Cape Cod Times is Ethan Gender. Good morning.
Morning.
Good to
Mindy.
See you. So lots of remembrances happening to mark the 75th anniversary of D-Day around the world. But on the Cape Cod Military Museum is marking the anniversary with an exhibit through June 30th. Tell us a little bit more about this.
Yeah, so one of my favorite sayings is there's always a Cape Cod connection. And that really, with D-Day, a lot of the stuff, preparations, a lot of stuff happened over here on the Cape, especially with Camp Edwards. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the preparations, soldiers would put on 70-pound packs and march from Bourne to Sandwich in preparation for battles over in Europe. They would do kind of practice invasions, marching from Mashpee to launch boats out on the Vineyard. There was another thing they did to test if they could do fuel lines between England and France, and they did that over here. They ran it between the Cape and Vineyard. So, yeah, there's a lot of these strange Cape connections. They perfected duck boats out here. Yeah. So, yeah, Camp Edwards was really kind of the training spot.
Yeah, it was what one of the greatest testing areas. And Camp Edwards also operated a hospital for wounded that were returning soldiers. Was the largest rehabilitation hospital in the country at that time. Who knew, right?
Yeah, I think like 71,000 wounded soldiers, I think, went through there. And for people who don't know, Camp Edwards is now Joint Base Cape Cod. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it even was held like 2,500 prisoners of war from the North African campaign over there. So, yeah, it was.
And Donald Jerry Ellis is a local historian and co-founder of the museum. And, you know, it's interesting. I didn't really think about this until he mentioned this in the Cape Cod Times, saying given the lack of local events to mark the anniversary, he thinks the museum plays an important role in keeping those memories alive. So true. There really wasn't a lot happening here yesterday to mark that. So for folks who might have been looking elsewhere, they have until June 30th, right, to check this out.
Yeah, and Jerry has been, he was a former selectman. He's really pushed kind of the museum into what it is today over there in Bourne. And yeah, I think he said something like the classic adage, if we forget history, it's bound to repeat itself.
Yeah. Since we're talking about Joint Base Cape Cod, we have the new Cape Cod Police Academy coming. I was surprised how reasonable tuition sounds.
Yeah, no, it's something, I mean, they've been pushing for a municipal academy around here for a while. They're also talking about moving the fire academy over there. So yeah, I mean, it's, I think, a little under $4,000 a student.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah, it's something that everyone, or a lot of people in the law enforcement community have been really pushing for, saying we're kind of behind. Hiring's always been a struggle out here.
Get some training right here and hopefully, yeah. And then you mentioned the fire training issues, and we've had that issue with the PFAS, which we've been talking about in the news for quite a bit now. So you want to have well-trained firefighters, but you also want to have clean water, so maybe that's the solution, right, that they're looking at moving that out?
Yeah, it's kind of been this tug of war between those two kind of parties, is having, you really want to have good fire safety training, make sure, again, because it's really hard to get quality firefighters and kind of retain them down here with housings and other issues. But again, these PFAS, which is these kind of chemicals that they don't really break down. They seemed they were using firefighting foam out on the academy for a while, up until 2009. They can get into the groundwater, and it's been, I think, in the last few, I think some 4 years, it's been twice that they've kind of put out advisories for some of the most vulnerable people in the community, pregnant women, stuff like that. So, yeah, it's been this kind of tug of war between... But they seem there's plans, like you said, to move the fire academy over to the base. And I mean, one of the big issues is you want to have to use water in fire training. I mean,
of course, yeah.
Kind of makes sense. You can't really have a fire academy without water training. And one of the issues is if you keep using that water, it kind of can further spread the PFAS contamination that's already out there even farther into the water. And PFAS is still something that we're kind of still learning about. It's kind of this emerging concern, I think the state labels it. So yeah, it's a big concern out there, and I mean, like, we got one
sole source aquifer. We had to be paying attention, right? Exactly.
Yeah.
All right, joining us now is Josh Bolling from the Inquirer. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Kevin Spacey in court on Nantucket this week for a hearing related to evidence in his case of alleged sexual assault. Tell us what's the latest on this.
He was. He made a surprise appearance, actually. There was a pretrial hearing scheduled for Monday in Nantucket District Court, but Kevin Spacey had been excused from attending that pretrial hearing, as he had with a couple of other pretrial hearings since his arraignment. But when the hearing began, he was seated next to his defense attorney, Alan Jackson, who took the opportunity to really slam prosecutors for the way in which they've handled cell phone information related to those accusations that Spacey groped an 18-year-old busboy at the Club Car Bar in July 2016. Jackson said that information was removed from the accuser's cell phone prior to it being turned over to investigators, a fact that he was never informed of, he said, during the pretrial hearing. He said that when prosecutors received permission from the alleged victim's mother, a former Boston television news anchor, Heather Unruh, in November 2018 to access the phone, she told the state trooper that had her sign the consent form that she had deleted what she called all the frat boy activities from her son's cell phone. And Jackson said he was never made aware of those comments. He said that the information he received regarding the cell phone was incomplete. He asked Judge Thomas Barrett to order the defense be provided a complete forensic download of the alleged victim's cell phone, including deleted information, the cell phone itself, and Unruh's cell phone. Shortly thereafter, he also said his client is ready for trial and requested a trial date within the next 8 weeks, but Judge Barrett kind of laughed a little bit and said that wasn't possible, that October or November would probably be the likely earliest possible time that a trial could begin. The next pretrial hearing is set for July 8th.
And Ethan, the Kevin Spacey's attorneys are accusing the Cape DA's office of bias. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Alan Jackson was pretty, I wasn't there personally, but from everything I've seen and read, he was pretty fiery, and I don't know for people who've never been to a pretrial hearing, they're normally pretty boring affairs. it's kind of just date setting most of the time. So this was really, really something else. They're worried that evidence was removed from this phone that could exculpatory evidence, basically. I think they were worried about possible connections with Mike Trudeau, an assistant district attorney. His sister knows Unruh well, supposedly. It's this kind of thing.
And this isn't anything that Michael Trudeau has hidden. I mean, he's been upfront about this, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the prosecution's basically saying Jackson is just giving the media something to know on with all of this. Like I said, pretrial hearings are usually just kind of stamp, let's next date, see in July.
Josh, Conservation Commission getting some extra time to review a major erosion control project?
They are. It's a project that they've been debating for over a year, and they actually wrapped up and closed the public hearing on it 2 weeks ago. But on Monday, they were given until June 20th by the applicant to rule on the Sconchet Beach Preservation Fund's proposed 3,000-foot extension to the geotextile tubes that line the base of the Sankaty Bluff after a couple of commissioners said they were still undecided and they didn't know that they'd be able to reach a decision, the appropriate decision, in the time frame that they were originally allotted until June 10th. A couple of the commissioners said they're concerned that the proposed extension of the project might actually increase erosion at the ends of each tube, diminish the beach over time, and have some potential negative impact to bird habitat and marine habitat in the area. Proponents say, on the other hand, that environmental impact is negligible or non-existent, that the project that's there now, about 1,000 feet of geotextile tubing, is working, that they've been dumping sand on top of it and on the ends, and that there hasn't been any additional significant erosion. And on the other hand, also, it's necessary to protect the homes and the street at the top of the bluff at the far east end of the island that has seen some pretty significant erosion over the last three decades or so. Some of those homes have had to be moved, and a couple of them were actually demolished that got too close to the bluff and were in danger of going over.
You know, interesting, and lately we've been talking a lot about decline in school enrollment. And Josh, high school graduates, you had the largest class in history on Saturday?
Saturday, the largest class in Nantucket High School history is going to graduate in the high school auditorium. They'll hold that honor for just a year. Each class has been the largest class. Next year's incoming senior class has about 150 students in it. This class is 136 graduating seniors. So the enrollment trend on Nantucket has generally for the last decade or so been up. It's been significantly up. Classes a decade or more ago had less than 100 students in it. A couple decades ago had closer to 50 or 60 students in it.
Wow.
But the rising population on the island, rising tide lifts all boats, I guess, and it lifts kids as well as adults. People come here to for employment opportunities. They bring kids with them. And they have children here, and the schools are getting filled. School officials have discussed potential expansion of the high school and middle school. A new intermediate school was just built a couple of years ago to expand the elementary school. But this class has seen a lot of changes over the last 12, 13 years they've been in school. The majority of them are going on to colleges and universities. A handful have chosen the military. Some are going straight to work, and a couple of them are actually taking a year off or so before they decide what they want to do. But 1 o'clock on Saturday, the auditorium is going to be full of students, family, and friends congratulating the class of 2019.
All right, Josh Bolling from the Inquirer Mirror. Thanks, Josh, for joining us.
Thank you.
Ethan, it's graduation season, and we've seen all kinds of commencement things happening here. I think one of my favorites was actually Governor Baker talking to the upper tech graduates saying, put the cell phones down.
Yeah, it's a classic graduation speech. And Governor Baker, I think at one point he said, most of what comes flying over social media is noise, and you need to know that it's not the real world. The real world is here now. It's your parents, your family, your teachers, your friends, your coworkers. Right. So, it's kind of this message to be present.
Be in the real world.
Which is kind of the old time graduation speeches, enjoy the moment. Right?
And Cuddy Hunk Elementary School had one lone grad.
Yeah, so K through 8 school, graduation's later this month. Gwen Lynch. Her brother was her only other counterpart in this one-room schoolhouse in Cuddy Hunk. And, she's going to have a fun experience out there. Jenny Slate, the actress, possibly best known for her time on Parks and Rec. Mm-hmm. She was in Zootopia as well, a few other things. She's going to be the speaker out there. She's got some Cuddy Hunk connections. But, yeah, it should be, I think, because if people don't know about Cuddy Hunk, it's this very square mile island.
Very small.
Year-round population's about a dozen. I think census puts it at 50 people. It kind of does explode in the summer, but it's not the regular school experience. So I think they really try and get important speakers, big names, to kind of really make these kids feel it is something. They don't get that normal experience at proms, dances, stuff like that.
How fun to be the audience one-on-one like that.
And Jenny's been getting to know Gwen. It's kind of probably the most famous eighth grade graduation out there at the moment. It should be pretty exciting. And last year they had a retired astronaut.
Oh, wow.
For her brother. Yeah, so it's something that I think, they really try and make it. It's a pretty special event if you ever get the chance to go.
Yeah. All right, now joining us on the phone is Noah Asamoah. He's from the Martha's Vineyard Gazette. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, you've been following the story of the Aquinnah Wampanoag tribe's efforts to move forward with their plans for a bingo hall. What's the latest on that?
So I guess here's kind of the status right now. In February, the tribe cleared 4 acres of land off State Road in Sleepy Aquinnah, which, normally there aren't heavy machinery running around there. Then they announced in a press release they would construct this 10,000-square-foot permanent – no one really knows what it's going to look like, but they say a sort of permanent tent facility that would have 250 electronic games. But then that, when the town saw that this press release came out, they referred the project to the Martha's Vineyard Commission. There was a bunch of angry letters exchanged between the town and the tribe in which the town said, please stop construction. We need to know about public safety. We have traffic concerns. We have concerns about wastewater. And the tribe, after the letters, remained totally steadfast in, its assertion of sovereign rights. They said, we don't want the town or commission to get involved. And this was all in February, so kind of jumping ahead to today, construction is still halted. We don't totally know why. And the town has requested a district court judge to file a motion for final judgment in an earlier case that says while the town doesn't argue that the tribe has the right to build or pursue the facility, they want to make sure or they want the judge to say that they have to get town building permits before they can start construction. So that's what's getting argued in district court right now.
So what about the sovereign rights, Noah? I mean, what responsibility do they have to, you know, like, where, of course, you can say the town is concerned about public safety. I'm sure the tribe probably is as well.
Sure.
But, you know, what about those sovereign rights?
Well, I think that's kind of the scope of those sovereign rights is the question that's being discussed in court right now. While the matter is actually totally a technical one, it's an entry of final judgment, which is supposed to be done but never was. It has implications on whether, you know, local building permits, whether the tribe needs to go through things like the Martha's Vineyard Commission, is necessary. You know, IGRA, which is the Indian Gaming Regulation Act, granted the tribe the right to build this Class II gambling facility. But the question of whether they need these permits is still kind of unknown. The judge, after 45 minutes of testimony, said, you know, I find these issues to be tenebrous, which is a word meaning, you know, shadowy, dark, or obscure. And so it's really a big question. And I think the tribe feels that they're getting attacked by the town that they think the town is using this as a way to just thwart them from building it all. But the judge, Judge Saylor, said during the hearing, and he was very clear about this, that even if he does rule, hypothetically, he was saying, that they need to get these building permits, the town can't use them to stop construction. They can use them to say, oh, you need to have an outlet that's 2 inches from this door, or you need to have a door that's this tall, or you need to have this kind of public safety set up. And it's not, you just can't build it.
Right.
So, yeah.
It'll be interesting to see. 10,000 square feet's a pretty big, you know, people who haven't been out on those roads. And those are some pretty small, little narrow roads. So it will be interesting to see, you know, how that all pans out once it actually gets built and open.
No question. I think that, you know, one of the biggest issues right now for the town is, like, there are pretty much no other commercial operations in the town of Aquinnah. They barely have 300 year-round residents. Actually, to get there, for people who don't know the island, you have to drive through pretty much every other town.
Right.
And so both the towns of Aquinnah and Chilmark have referred the project to the commission, saying, you know, we don't know what it's going to be like with regard to traffic. We don't know how they're going to get people there. We don't know the hours they're going to be open. And the tribe is like, well, that's not really your business. So that's what's getting hashed out.
All right, we'll stay tuned. Noah Asimo from the Martha's Vineyard Gazette. Thanks so much, Noah, for bringing us an update. We appreciate that.
Hey, thank you.
It's a news roundup. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. On Beacon Hill, House lawmakers passed a bill this week allowing unions to charge non-members certain fees and give labor leaders access to non-members' contact information. The bill is a response to a Supreme Court ruling last year called the Janus decision that forbade unions from charging fees to workers who don't pay union dues, even if they benefit from the collective bargaining process. WCAI's Catherine Iden talked with State House reporter Mike Dean about how this new bill may or may not ease recent tensions between state lawmakers and union leaders.
So, Mike, we do have some labor news with the State House, but you had also kind of in anticipation, I think, of this, taken a look at this relationship, which labor and lawmakers is one of the most important relationships in our state government. So how is that relationship faring right now?
Yeah, well, it's better right now, and that's because the House of Representatives did pass a pretty major bill that labor unions, organized labor, had been asking for to correct or kind of help them out when it comes to something that the U.S. Supreme Court did last year. But prior to that, that bill hadn't been moving, and that was one of many, many different pressure points that was kind of bubbling up between labor and the legislature, especially the House. It was one of these scenarios that we see an awful lot these days where the Senate was passing more progressive, more liberal initiatives, and the House was really digging its heels and not moving that legislation forward. And that was really the story of last session. And that had consequences where a lot of big-name labor unions did not support incumbent House candidates and very openly criticized House leadership for not bringing the labor agenda to a vote. So it was something of a feud between some of the top labor leaders and Speaker Robert DeLeo that may be on the mend now, but has been bubbling for some time.
Yeah, they really kind of demonstrated how much power they have over impacting what happens on Beacon Hill with some of the tactics that they use.
Absolutely, yeah. And those tactics that kind of came into question, I guess you can say it went from behind the scenes, which is where most things in state politics happen, to in front of the scenes. And what really occurred last month was kind of a flashpoint here, where Dorchester Representative Dan Cullinane really called out AFL-CIO President Stephen Tolman for the rhetoric and tactics that had been taken up by the AFL-CIO and really some other labor organizations, where he didn't call Tolman by name, but in live testimony to the Labor Committee, everyone in that room knew he was talking about Tolman, the AFL-CIO president, who is a former senator from Brighton and is a very, very well-known and very powerful figure up here on Beacon Hill. That was a shot across the bow in public that really is unprecedented in this kind of labor house feud.
Mm. We have some tape of Cullinane and his comments. Let's take a listen.
It's far too important of an issue to the workers and to the Massachusetts economy to be left to the usual bluster and BS of those who only seek to yell and scream and name call at rallies when the cameras are on.
This kind of started, though, this tiff with the wage theft bill, right? I mean, there's a kind of a package of bills that they wanted. But talk to us about this wage theft bill and the tension that has sprung up from that.
Right. Cullinane's comments came at the hearing on that wage theft bill. That's why it was so packed with labor leaders. What this does is it would do a lot of things. But one of the main things is it would make general contractors liable for wage theft perpetrated by subcontractors. So what is wage theft? That's really any kind of abusive employment tactic, not paying your workers, paying them less than they deserve, you know, saying that the work is only 90% quality, so we're only going to pay them 90%, things like that. And it's a big, big deal in the trade unions in construction. Now, these major construction companies that are the general contractors, they do not want to be on the hook for actions from smaller companies that might not have the cleanest accounting and books and things like that. And this is why the labor unions want to make them liable to kind of clean up this system. Cullinane had some particular bits he wanted to get into that bill. There was some resistance from labor that he thought was unnecessary, and that's kind of what led to his kind of open comments and his open criticism of Tolman. But yeah, this wage theft bill is now that that Janus bill has passed, wage theft is the number one priority for labor up on the Hill. And it's a big fight between business, who does not want to be liable for this, and labor, who, you know, of course, does want this bill to pass.
Mm. And so does that mean that this rift may get even bigger? It kind of looked at first like, oh, things might be patching up, but there still are some bones of contention here.
Any session will have bones of contention because there's going to be a legislative agenda. You know, there's certain things they want to get passed in labor, and some things that the speaker may not want to take up. That Janus bill they passed yesterday was very friendly to labor, and that passed very much according to DeLeo's method. It passed 157-1. So that means that virtually every Republican voted for this pro-labor bill. Only one Republican voted off of the bill. This is how DeLeo operates. He wants a completely unanimous vote from the chamber from 160 members, and that takes an awful long time to hammer out behind the scenes before he can bring it to the floor. So instead of passing something with a slim majority, the way advocates might want, DeLeo wants everyone on board, and that slows the system down.
I want to talk now about some other news this week on Beacon Hill. Lawmakers once again took up a bill to update the state's sex education law. And I said once again, Mike, because this bill has passed in the Senate but seems to wither in the House each time it comes up. Why?
Basically, there's no real clear reason why this bill doesn't come to a vote in the House. I think we say this over and over again when it comes to a lot of these progressive initiatives, is that the Senate will pass this bill no problem. They have the last few sessions, and there's plenty of support in it now to take it up again. But the House simply doesn't think that it's, you know, done or ready or through the process just yet. It's got, you know, dozens and dozens of co-sponsors on this bill on the House side. It's got well over a majority of House members already signed on to it. However, it has not come up for a vote. And if you want to read between the lines, that means because those non-co-sponsoring Democrats are on the more conservative side of things. So what we're really dealing with here is conservative Democrats, a number of which are, you know, senior members in leadership, kind of around Speaker DeLeo, who probably just don't want to vote on this or don't think they should vote on it or, you know, may want to vote against it but don't want to be seen as voting against something like overhauling sex ed, there is some vocal opposition to it from kind of more conservative, family-oriented kind of right-wing groups who say that it could take away a parent's role in deciding what kind of teaching is up to them when it comes to you know, sex ed. But I think as far as why Beacon Hill doesn't put this forward, it is because of a lot of conservative Democrats really not willing to take up the vote.
So not House Speaker DeLeo, in a sense. I mean, we were just talking about the fact that he likes to kind of have widespread near unanimous vote for certain things. You don't think that's the case? You think it's that there's actually really a break in the group here with people actually really disagreeing with this?
I think it's both. Those two things aren't mutually exclusive. DeLeo wants almost every member of the House to vote for any legislation that gets taken up on the floor. That labor bill that we talked about before only had one Republican member vote off of it. That means that everybody's got to be on board. If he has some members, especially senior ones who are close to him, who don't think that the bill is something they want to put their name on, DeLeo is not going to hang them out to dry. He's not going to hang anybody out to dry. If the process goes on and you can get 140, 150 people to sign on to something like this, then it'll come to the floor. And again, it's a 160-member chamber. But you're going to need those huge margins before DeLeo is going to let something like this onto the floor.
What's actually in the measure that would we've been calling it updating sex education?
Yeah, it would basically bring it up to speed, make a curriculum for the entire state. It would not mandate that school districts teach these things, but it would update the curricula that are available to schools when they teach sex ed, and it would make it medically accurate. One of the more controversial things here is that it would introduce a lot of newer topics to what is really an outdated sex ed curriculum, things like teaching about sexual consent, things like LGBTQ issues, including gender identity and transgender issues. That's something that the student body is so far beyond what they are being taught. And this is something that the state would, you know, bring up and really update the lessons that teachers have access to. And it would also do a lot around women's health that is lacking in the curriculum as it is right now. And that means talking about, you know, pregnancy, prevention of pregnancy, and abortion. So it's all those types of topics that can be very touchy. That's kind of the whole point of sex ed. It's those lessons to make them medically accurate.
But an uphill climb, not necessarily something we're going to see become law this session.
There is more momentum this session than there has been in the past, but again, it will be a tricky deal to get the amount of support DeLeo insists on.
And that's Mike Dean, WCAI State House reporter. Mike, thanks. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
And Catherine Auden talking to Mike Dean. It is News Roundup. We're talking about the top stories of the region. And joining us now from the Cape Cod Chronicle is Tim Wood. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Mindy.
So some delays in the fishing pier observation deck is causing some frustration, I guess you could say.
I guess you could say that, yeah. The town has embarked on a major construction project at the town fish pier, replacing the observation deck and much of the parking lot along with underground fuel tanks there. It's pretty much closed off the facility for the public. And at this point, with fishing season gearing up, commercial fishermen in town are getting a little anxious about the work that's going on there because they don't have access to a large part of the, not only the parking lot, but the hoists and other equipment that they use to offload their fish are not there at this point. And the project is at least a month behind schedule. This past week, commercial fisherman Doug Feeney, who's also chairs the Aunt Lydia's Cove Committee, which oversees the facility, went to selectmen and said, you know, this, you guys got to move this along. We're gearing up to get going here, and we can't and we don't have access here. That's one aspect of this. The other aspect is the tourists. This is one of the town's major tourist attractions. It attracts sometimes as many as 3,000 people a day during the summer. The observation deck had to be repaired or replaced, actually, because structurally it was problematic. It was limited to 100 people at one time. And the plans call for a larger deck with a new sort of a handicap access and everything. But the project was supposed to be finished in mid-May. And the contractor said the weather during the late winter and spring was wet, and they were unable to get some of the parts they needed, and so they're behind.
Mm.
And the town has given them an extension through June 26th, that's sort of the drop dead date at this point. And Doug Feeney warned the Board of Selectmen that they better stick with that deadline, and they also better have an alternate plan if that doesn't happen.
Yeah, I knew it was a busy spot. I didn't realize up to 3,000 people a day. Wow, that's a lot more than I thought. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very busy. People come to watch. You can see seals there usually, but we went down there this weekend. There were a few tourists milling around, and there were no seals because there were no fishermen offloading
right,
the fish. So
yeah,
they were kind of disappointed there.
And then another story, some mystery deposits at a bank in Orleans. Everybody loves a mystery.
Everybody loves a mystery. At the Orleans branch of the Rockland Trust, last summer, someone began leaving drawings, sketches, at the bank's ATM lobby on the back of flyers and sort of on scrap paper. And as the weeks went by, the bank workers, bank staff, started finding more and more of this art. And it gradually grew more elaborate. Color was added, and they became sort of landscapes. They were really, some of them were really quite nice, but the artist has remained anonymous. And the bank staff began even leaving out paper for the artist to use to encourage him. They've collected the pieces of art into a book that's on display in the lobby. But so far, the artist has not come forward. This is an ATM lobby that's open for people with access 24 hours a day. So anybody could be doing this with a bank card.
Mm-hmm.
The bank manager Valerie LaBelle suspects that the artist is a snowbird because the art stopped in the fall, and it just started up again around Memorial Day.
Mm.
They even went around to the galleries in the area to see if they could recognize the style of this person, and they've had no luck. So it's created a kind of a delightful mystery for the bank and its customers.
Yeah.
And they've encouraged the artists to keep coming back and giving them more art.
I like how you call it a delightful mystery. That's and I know you'll stay on it, Tim, and you'll let us know what
happens.
We'll
be following to see if the mystery is solved and the identity is revealed.
All right, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thanks, Tim, for that. All right, joining us from the Provincetown Banner is Casey Myers. Hi, Casey.
Hi, Mindy. How are you?
Great. So there's a proposal for a memorial to the Wampanoag tribe, and it's ending in a stalemate, right? Does this look like this is it? Or what's happening?
No, well, it's not it, but it's probably it for 2020, which is, of course, a big international celebration of the 400th anniversary of the landing of the Mayflower in Provincetown Harbor. And so the town is just trying very hard to get a bunch of things ready for 2020. And one of them was a memorial for the Wampanoag people. And it had been planned for several years in Provincetown, but only in the last year have designs really been brought forward. And the reception thus far for the design has not been positive. Racial Justice Provincetown, the proponents of the design, have a design of a memorial. It's a rough cut black granite boulder, approximately 8 feet long and 3 feet high, and it has inscriptions in both Wampanoag and English. The proponents say it's an intentional contrast to the nearby monument, which is, of course, the bas relief, a neoclassical relief depicting the signing of the Mayflower Compact. Racial Justice Provincetown focused their design on language and storytelling, connection to the earth. They also have emphasized the fact that they would like it to be done with the Wampanoag's terms, on their own terms. And yet, other people in Provincetown do not want this monument to be next to the bas relief, and they say the current design looks like a tombstone. So the other big issue of contention is the location. The Racial Justice Provincetown and the Wampanoag really, really want it to be in front of the bas relief, right at the sidewalk on Bradford Street, and then the bas relief is behind it, so it would be taller, and this lower monument would be in front. And once again, many people in town say, oh, no, please don't do that. They would like it either on the left side of the bas relief or on the right side. And others say they would like it to be in an entirely different location down at the First Landing Park, which is, I don't know if people know the West End Rotary in Provincetown, but it leads out to Long Point. Mm-hmm. On a breakwater. Anyway, there's a big park there, and many people have suggested that might be the ideal place for a memorial for the Wampanoag. And this is where it's really stalled out.
Tough to get 100% consensus on whatever you come up with, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And this is really starting with the two basics, location and design. They're not getting anywhere. So,
right. So more talks to come on that. Then quickly, tell us about, Carnival in Provincetown isn't until August, but you might not know that if you were visiting this week.
Yeah, exactly. If you were visiting this week on one block only. But if you were on one block, you would see three floats, about a million balloons and a ton of glitter and tons of drag queens all dressed up. And if you were just on that block, you would think it's August already. If you take a step away from that block, it's completely
back to reality.
Yeah, and that's because Starz Network is filming Hightown, their TV series that they're doing, which is set in Provincetown. And they're doing most of the filming in New York, but they've been in Provincetown all week, shooting scenes on the pier and sunsets, beaches, and most centrally this carnival scene, which is just, according to the pilot, which we read, we don't know if it's the official pilot, but the pilot has the star, Monica Raymond, or Jackie Quinones, as she's called in the series, walking down Commercial Street after her boat patrol was ending for the day. She's a hard-partying lesbian National Marine Fisheries official. And she's just walking down Commercial Street during Carnival. So that's what they're, the scene they were shooting.
So now people go, oh, that's what that was. All right, Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner, thanks for bringing us up to date. Appreciate that.
Okay.
It's a news roundup. We'll talk more after a quick break. It's the news roundup on The Point, and now joining us on the phone is George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Morning, George.
Good morning, Mindy.
So some more troubles on the Steamship Authority?
Oh, yes. earlier this week, the island home, there was an incident where there was hydraulic fluid. They have these lifts on the island home, for people who aren't familiar with it, where they can put a second deck of cars. It lifts them up, sort of like a garage lift when your car's in for maintenance. And so those are run off of hydraulics, and there's fluid in there, and apparently one of the hoses let go, and it let go all over a truck.
Yikes.
A pickup truck. The gentleman who was driving it, Frank Cray, had his window open, so it got inside the truck. He estimates it was 20 to 30 gallons of fluid by the time all was said and done. We heard about this, and we reached out to the Steamship Authority, and their first response was, that it affected two cars, and the operators of those vehicles were cooperative and weren't really too upset about things, and that they had helped them out, and that just set Mr. Cray off. He said that wasn't the case at all, that he had to really seek out getting even paper towels and a bucket of water. And so we have a video interview with him on our website as well. And, a day afterwards, he came by our office, and you could still smell the hydraulic fluid, even though he had washed the outside off. It had seeped into the carpeting, and that was still soaked inside the car. The Steamship Authority is telling him to get an estimate on what it would take to fix the pickup truck, which he's in the process of doing. But they didn't even offer the guy, the free passage until he really spoke out about this. And they came back and said, we'll take care of your ferry ride. Incidentally, he was going off island to a doctor's appointment, and he was so covered in the fluid himself that the doctor said, I can't see you like this.
Oh, wow.
A doctor's appointment he had waited a few months for.
So I assume the Steamship Authority is trying to address that issue so that doesn't happen again. Just a freak accident, or do we know why that let go?
Well, the interesting thing is they're saying that it was some sort of a ring that let go. Mr. Cray took photos and shared them with us that show that there was a bucket up on the ceiling underneath this hydraulic lift that appeared to be put there by someone to maybe catch, you know, little drops of fluid.
A temporary fix
at the time, and then it let loose. We don't know that for a fact. Mm-hmm. We asked the Steamship Authority about that. They said that they didn't know anything about a bucket. Pictures don't lie.
Mm. All right, so another story this week. State lacrosse playoffs begin this week, but the girls' varsity head coach and the assistant head coach are suspended.
That's right. This all has to do with rules for kids being in school or not being in school in this case, and then showing up at practice. So that's what happened here. They had not gone to school on a certain day. But then they showed up for practice, and the coaches took the fall for that. There is something else afoot here, Mindy. We don't know all the details, but there was some sort of a senior skip day, and that involved going to a beach. There might have been alcohol involved. Mm. So far, the school says that they investigated it, and they're being very cryptic about whether anybody faced any sanctions for that. In terms of the lacrosse team, they did play their first playoff game yesterday. They did win, and all but one player was on the field. And again, we don't know whether that was an injury or whether she faced some sort of sanction for this senior skip day. But it's been quite a dramatic week over at Martha's Vineyard High School, when they ought to be just looking forward to Sunday's graduation.
Exactly. All right, George Brennan, Martha's Vineyard Times. Thanks so much, George. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
You too. Now joining us in studio is Heather Goldstone, host of Living Lab Radio and WCAI science correspondent. Morning, Heather.
Good morning.
All right, science news this week. A right whale found dead in Canada. And this is a whale that was no stranger to Cape Cod Bay. So what do we know?
Right. So it's a whale named Wolverine. Many of, you know, there are only about a little over 400 of these North Atlantic right whales left at this point, and many of them do have names associated with them. Researchers essentially know almost all of these whales. Wolverine was a 9-year-old male, and he got his name actually because he had these three big propeller scars from a large ship that had, obviously the propeller had hit him when he was quite young. He also is just completely emblematic of the challenges facing right whales at this point. He was entangled three times that researchers know of in his first 5 years of life. Wow. Two mild entanglements, one moderate entanglement. And now, you know, he's a 9-year-old male. And one researcher said to me a few months ago that without human actions, right whales would be almost immortal. They could live potentially hundreds, or at least 100 years. So for a 9-year-old male to be dead suggests that this is not natural causes. We don't have a cause of death, an official cause of death from officials at NOAA yet, but the dead whale was sighted by NOAA researchers who are up flying aerial surveys in Canadian waters, because for the past few years, we've seen large numbers of right whales going up into this area in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And you may remember in 2017, it was just horrific, right? 12 deaths in that area in the Gulf of St. Lawrence due to ship strikes and entanglement in fishing gear. So this sparked a lot of concerns. It was the first flight. They found a dead animal. Are we going to see another 2017, I think, was the immediate fear. Researchers so far are kind of saying, you know, Canada addressed it. There were no deaths last year. Too early to start freaking out and panicking about this, but obviously not a great
not
sign.
Not a good sign at all, yeah. And for folks who get the Boston Globe, your picture was on the front page on Saturday.
Well, yeah, and the story wasn't really about me.
No,
we're part of this great project, Report for America, which is really trying to enliven local reporting. We hear so much about the death of local news, and that's something, of course, that we're dedicated to here at WCAI, and this is particularly local environmental news growing out of some of our listeners may remember a lot of climate coverage for about 6 months last year. We had two fellows here. This is growing out of that. We have a new environment reporter, Eve Zuckoff, who's just started. You'll be hearing her on the air, definitely. She's already following, I think, three or four different stories. So
great to have her. What's coming up Monday on Living Lab?
Well, a few different things. One of them that might be of interest is we're talking with Alzheimer's researcher Rudy Tanzi, literally rock star researcher Rudy Tanzi, who's talking about some of the lifestyle factors that we know affect risk for Alzheimer's. And so some of the simple things you can start doing quite early, getting a good night's sleep, a plant-based, really, you know, healthy diet for your gut microbes, exercise, staying socially active. A lot of really simple suggestions that can really help your brain health.
All right. And that's Monday at 9. All right. Heather Goldstone, thanks for being with us. Also in studio with us is still Ethan Gettner, who's from the Cape Cod Times. And Cape Cod Woman of the Year is a longtime activist, and she is still going strong at 105 years old.
Yeah, absolutely. Juliet Bernstein, I would have definitely given out at least 100. but yeah, she received on Wednesday, it was the Mercy Otis Warren Cape Cod Woman of the Year Award. And so that's for pioneer women causes. It recognizes people in the community, leaders, who have made significant contributions in arts, education, business, community involvement, volunteerism. And she's been really active. I mean, she's been kind of all over the map on things that she's done. People may know her through, she kind of gained real national notoriety in the 80s. After she pushed for the Chatham Town Band, which was all male at the time, to include bylaws that would allow women. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the big things she's known for on Cape, but she got Chatham Town Meeting to pass a resolution to declare the town nuclear free. So, I mean, she's kind of been all over the map and really quite a presence out there in Chatham.
And from what I understand, when they told her she was, you know, winning this, she had nominated somebody else, I think, you know, so she's a humble woman on top of all of that. Yeah,
I think when someone said she was amazing, she was like, I'm not amazing. My mom is amazing. So, yeah, that's the kind of person Juliet is.
Yeah, that's great. All right, so photojournalist Steve Hislop has a really nice farewell to longtime Hyannis firefighter Tom Kenny. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so, I mean, Tom has been on the job, I think, 36 years off the top of my head here. He was somebody, made his way up to fire captain in the Hyannis Fire Department, one of the most active departments on the Cape. And he really was this kind of guy. Every time you went to a scene, I went to all these scenes, you would really see him there, always see him there. We may have recognized him most because he had this kind of very characteristic handlebar mustache. But yeah, he was really quite a presence in Hyannis and in that whole department, kind of always up. I mean, Steve, our photographer, wrote today, kind of, he'd make it to a scene sometimes later than they did, and he'd kind of be like, what are you busy sleeping in? Tom would tell him. So yeah, he was quite a character. Yeah, he passed away, I believe, on Wednesday this week.
And of course, Steve has a lot of great photos over the years that he's taken of him, and thus this tribute.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when you go to these scenes all the time, you kind of do kind of build this kind of work relationship with these people. Definitely, yeah.
Of course,
and Thomas.
And firefighters, I say, are unsung heroes. We love firefighters. All right, and then finally this morning, you did a story this week about some grant money that will preserve much of Cuttyhunk. Tell us about
that.
Yeah,
Cuttyhunk twice on the news roundup is quite an ordeal.
With that big population over there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's been kind of this ongoing effort between the Buzzards Bay Coalition and the town of Cuttyhunk to try and, surprisingly, if you've ever been out there, it's kind of very this idyllic kind of place, but there's not much conservation land out there. Almost everything's privately owned.
Surprising, too, right?
Yeah. And there's been kind of a very high tolerance for allowing people to go across private land and go get to the beach. But there's fears. A lot of parcels went up for sale not too long ago, and there's fears that, depending who buys them next, there could not be that tolerance anymore. Mm-hmm. So not getting to the beach. They just got more grants. There's a few grants coming through. But yeah, it's kind of this long campaign to really try and get. It's going to put about, I think there's 580 acres on Cuttyhunk. Put about half of them into conservation. So yeah, it's this really big, exciting project for a lot of people out there.
Yeah. And so now, this isn't an organization on Cuttyhunk that's doing it, or is it? Is it a conservation group there, or is it?
It's the Buzzard Bay Coalition.
Buzzard Bay Coalition. Okay, yeah, you did mention that. Yeah,
and they're based in New Bedford and Marion.
Great. All right. Cape Cod Times, Ethan Gettner. Thanks so much, Ethan, for being with us and bringing us up to date on the top stories of the week. Appreciate that.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.